areas of limited statehood, what do we mean by that? We mean areas, parts of a country where the state has trouble to implement or enforce decisions. Okay? You can call it weak institutions, weak statehood, etc. In some cases, sort of extreme cases, the state would not have any more a monopoly over the means of violence. So we find that if we go around the borderlands from the east all the way to the south, we find that on both sides of the EU border. It's not just a phenomenon in some third world country. You know, we think about the Democratic Republic Congo, Afghanistan, Somalia. We have it actually also inside the EU. Ukraine. I start now in the east, non-EU, Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, in the southern neighborhood, if you think Morocco, Tunisia, Libya. Libya is practically a failed state at the moment, and so forth. So that's very clear that these are huge areas of limited statehood. But look inside the EU, look into Bulgaria, look into Romania, look at southern Italy for decades, you know. It's Greece, I'd say, I'm sorry, Greece is still almost a fragile state. You know, if we want to talk about failed statehood inside the EU, Greece comes to mind first. You know, it's not a joke. I mean, it's not. I'm not making a normative statement here. It's just an analytical one. So this issue of areas of limited statehood is all pervasive. It's not such a phenomenon somewhere out there. And the same, this is my second concept, or the second from LISTCO. You know, LISTCO is this stands for limited statehood, and then CO is the contested order. Order contestations, you have it exactly at the borderlands, inside and outside the EU. Liberal order, liberal values are contested outside and inside EU borders, and start from Ukraine. On the other side of the border, it's Poland. Hello. And then we go down, we have Hungary, we have Italy, and we have the same essentially outside the EU. So, my last concept is what I would call the politicization of borders. In the context of the refugee and migration challenges, which then is again an inside-outside issue, you know, who belongs to us, who are we? You know, and who has a right to come in and so forth. And now, to put it this way, each of these challenges as such is not such a big deal. We can handle that. Contestations of orders in a democratic society are normal, by the way. But I think the confluence of these three trends, this raises new issues. And I'm not going to talk about EU foreign policy. I might do that later, and you guys can do this. Yeah, but I mean, it raises enormous challenges to the EU at the time, particularly since these challenges are both on the outside and the inside. And I'll just stop here for so.
Thomas, thank you very, very much for this very important introduction and putting some flesh on it. I owe a belated congratulations to Paul Morillas, who's now the director of CEDAW, this great institute in Barcelona, and Heather Grabby told me this is the finest building of think tanks in Europe. Anyway, Paul, thank you for coming, and congratulations again. Paul, Thomas was either throwing down the gauntlet to you about the EU foreign policy in the light of what he said. I mean, is there this foreign policy at work here in the context of what he says?
Thank you, Jude. Thank you to Carnegie as well for inviting us, this wonderful team of LISTCO researchers.
Wonderful building.
our building, but I'm used to it. So it is a pleasure to be here. And I want to take it from where Thomas left it, actually, and elaborate a bit on both topics that are in our panel discussion, EU foreign policy and borderlands, and challenge a bit these two dimensions. First one, on EU foreign policy, if we want to challenge it, I think we will all agree here that what's internal and what's external has vanished, in a sense. We cannot make a clear difference between what's internal security and external security, particularly in neighboring countries or in the borderlands. And the EUGS, the global strategy, of course, recognizes that. When Syrian refugees come in and generate a refugee crisis, then this becomes internal politics. When a plane is downed in Ukraine, this becomes internal politics. And when the association agreement with Ukraine is put into the referendum, this becomes internal politics. So there are many aspects today that cannot do not easily abide by this difference between internal and external. And as a consequence of that, this necessarily means that EU foreign policy issues become increasingly politicized. And this is what I'm building on from Thomas here. But the politicization of EU foreign policy basically means that certain issues that used to be considered outside issues, external issues, become increasingly incorporated into the agenda of those who make foreign policy. They become salient in the debates, and they mobilize a lot of actors around those questions, right? And this, of course, has immense consequences for the EU. Where EU foreign policy used to be ruled by this permissive consensus, right? It was one of the policies of the EU that was considered for a long time to enjoy larger degrees of consensus among both the public and the elites, right? So this has consequences for the nature of EU foreign policy in terms of its normative power, on the use of foreign policy for political purposes. And then, of course, this is capitalized by those who contest the order. Populist forces who try to capitalize on this internal-external nexus in foreign policy. Then the big question remains, and is it politicization of EU foreign policy a good thing for integration? Some will say that it is good because it brings political debates into the equation of foreign policy. And then this is the first step for more integration in foreign policy and defense. One can argue that PESCO has happened at the time where there is more contestation of foreign policy, but it is a relevant development. And others will argue that politicization is dangerous for integration because, of course, populists built on the capacity of mobilizing these actors, and then these actors contest the main ideas on foreign policy. So the question on whether it's good or bad, I think it's not solved and remains to be seen. On borderlines, second and last point, also challenging a bit the question of borderlands. In the East, much less knowledgeable than all those around here. But of course, Russian interference becomes something that is an internal aspect of many member states. In the borderlands, within the EU, and everywhere. And Russia is also trying to and attempting to construct its own order in here. So it's also trying to put forward a different idea of what borderlands are, not only for the EU, but also for Russia. And there is a contestation here on what borderlands are about. But most particularly on the south, and this is what I'm most interested in. In another project we're running, it's CEDAW MENARA project, what we've witnessed in the conclusions of the project is that the EU is doing very little on those areas that are of most concern to Arab populations. On the socioeconomic dimension in Arab countries, the divide between the haves and the have-nots has increased in the last few years. The EU has done very little to work on that. And also the center of gravity is very much shifting in the Mediterranean and the Middle East area. From the Middle East, we're turning our attention to the Gulf. From the North Africa, we're looking farther south, and we're looking to sub-Saharan Africa. In a certain sense, what I would argue is that borders in the south have disappeared. Today, what we see more than a border between Europe and the Mediterranean, it is rather a territorial continuum between Europe, the Mediterranean, and Africa. And this territorial continuum turns the Mediterranean Sea into a lake. So what matters at the end of the day is more the territorial integrity of these challenges that go from the north to the south than the division that the Mediterranean Sea provides. Of course, this has plenty of consequences for EU foreign policy, and I'll leave it here. The return of power politics, of course, is also reflecting a change of ideas. The EU needs to adapt to this new order, and of course, this comes together with a change of ideas of what its foreign policy is about. If it was used to be, if it used to be based on normative ideas and these are severely challenged, then this is even more so the case when EU foreign policy has become politicized. And in,
yeah.
and in last but not least, in the policy dimension, in the instrument dimension, to what extent does it make sense to still keep talking about the European neighborhood policy mm-hmm. if what we are seeing mm-hmm. is these territorial continuums happening in the East and the South? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's interesting that you mentioned the IRA, the integration word. I really didn't think of this, that this would come up. Is the politicization of EU foreign policy a good thing for integration? Integration is hardly mentioned there. And what wasn't mentioned, Heather, this is Heather Greiber. I think you all know Heather. She's director of Open Society, European Policy Institute, based in Brussels here, although I think you're rarely based in Brussels. I mean, you're rarely in Brussels, traveling a huge amount. But Heather, some things are absent from this discussion so far. I mean, we have the policymakers or the member states or the mm-hmm. chancelleries. But what about the other aspect of foreign policymakers?
So I'm just going to talk a little bit about the interaction between domestic politics and foreign policy. Some people here have worked on this a lot, Rosa, for example, and have thought about it a lot. But it's something that is constantly shifting and changing, in fact, and it's worth paying attention to because of the fact that, as Judy said at the beginning, more and more foreign policy is not made in the foreign ministries. Foreign ministers are now often number 3, 4, even 5 or 6 in the government, whereas it always used to be number mm-hmm. 2 because the finance minister and the interior minister come above them in the pecking order. And increasingly, foreign policy is made, yes, in the chancelleries and the presidential palaces, but also in the interior ministries. Mm. The trade ministries to a certain extent and finance economics, but interior ministries have become really significant players in foreign policy, particularly on the borderlands. And for them, the big word is the B word. It's all about the border. And it's all about hardening the border and showing the population it's about hardening the border. And I think it's worth just pausing for a moment to think about how this is affecting those regions in particular. We're all used to hearing about the way that the dominance of migration on foreign policy, on EU foreign policy, is affecting so many different things. It means taking resources, and of course resources are both money, but they're also political attention, away from long-term priorities, development, the idea of long-term strategic interests, and towards short-term, just stopping mm-hmm. people from moving, doing deals that make sure that people don't move, and so on. But that's especially important for borderlands, not only because that's where people cross the border, and therefore there are going to be more fences and more money spent on controls, which affects very much not only the kind of small-scale trade that has mm-hmm. always been there historically mm-hmm. in borderlands, and which often keeps the peace, actually prevents frictions from building up yeah. in the population either side of the border, because people do know each other, yeah. And there's often a mixing of languages and so on. But also it's significant because it essentially presents a very different face of Europe towards the other side of that border. Mm. And so if you think about, for example, Ukraine's various borders with EU mm-hmm. countries, and that the way that that has changed over the past, say, 30 years, we went through a period when the EU wanted to see change in those regions. The EU saw its strategic interest as being in change. Move away from the Soviet Union, move towards a borderless, frictionless Europe mm. in which there were special passes, for example, of people who were living in the border region to be able to go across the border without a visa mm. in order to facilitate cross-border trade and integration of civil mm. society, encouraging school exchanges. There was a huge... So the strategic interest of the EU at that point was on change in those countries and on as much movement as people yeah. as possible. So professional associations, school exchanges, and so on. And there was also a big focus on the making borders less important, mm. de-emphasizing them as a means of healing historical divides and historical wounds, and leading to reconciliation, which would, you know, in the same logic of European integration, lead to less friction and the yeah. less likelihood of wars and violence, also intercommunal violence, you know, just between villages and between ethnicities in the future. And there were some member states, which these days it sounds a bit odd, but in those days it seemed quite logical that, for example, Hungary was in the vanguard of borderless Europe.
Yes.
Hungary was super keen on as much immigration and emigration across the borderlands as possible, because that was a way of keeping the Hungarian minorities, Hungarian ethnic and speaking minorities, in, for example, Ukraine, as well as in, you know, for a while, Romania, which was still outside the EU when Hungary joined, as part of the sort of Hungarian sphere of influence, but also with access to language and so on. So Hungary was one of the biggest proponents. The other huge proponent was, of course, Poland, which was desperate to keep the free flow of workers from Ukraine, but also to, again, try and, you know, let's bring back Lviv back into the Polish sphere of influence. Well, that's one way of putting it. Another way of putting it is to encourage, you know, Polish-speaking people, minorities in those regions to have links with Poland, and also for trade, for commerce, for investment, for economic reasons. There was every reason to do that. Those two member states, Hungary and Poland, were the biggest proponents of borderless Europe and de-emphasizing borders for 15 years. After, a good 15 years, maybe in some, actually 20 in the case of Poland.
Yes.
And that was one of their biggest priorities in foreign policy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how many conferences did some of us go to in Lublin, for example, on EU Eastern policy being all about promoting civil society connections and engagement? How many conferences did the Hungarian foreign ministry hold on let's celebrate ethnic diversity across borderless Europe? So the migration crisis has had much bigger ramifications, even than just drawing more political attention, money, and essentially just more foreign policy resources to the south from the east, and further south and further east, as you were saying. But it's also had a significant impact because it's turned the two greatest, and this is not just because of the migration crisis, it's because of the way it connected with domestic politics, but the two greatest proponents of borderless Europe into the greatest proponents of let's put up as many borders and barriers as possible. In rhetorical terms, and yet, if you actually look at the flow of people across those borders, the biggest immigration into Europe in the past 18 months is Ukrainians coming to work in Poland, where the economy is still growing at 5% and there are labour shortages. So there's also a paradox that the kind of rhetorical support for some of these things isn't actually matched by the reality.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there are the two other very big challenges that we see, the big changes, that populism at home makes the EU draw in its horns abroad, particularly on the normative agenda, values agenda. That's happening in many parts of the world. Here in particular, it's a focus on stability and avoiding disruption rather than promoting a normative agenda which leads to change. And there's a circle of influence between foreign policy and domestic politics through, of course, Russian interference, disinformation, all these things that we know about, no need to go into the details here, but people in the borderlands are particularly prone to getting multiple sources of information about what's going on, many of which are much louder voices than the rather quiet voice of their own foreign ministry. So if you want to understand what's happening in Crimea right now, and you live in Lviv even, what kind of television are you getting, let alone if you live on the other side of the border in Slovakia or Hungary or Poland? If you speak Russian, you can get much more access, rather more quickly, to very slick and very fancy-looking reports on what's going on there from Russia Today, for example, Sputnik, and so on. And so there's the feedback loop into EU foreign policy through those member state governments, through how people vote, because of those sources of information. So these broader trends that we see around the relationship between domestic politics and foreign policy at EU level, they are particularly important for the borderlands.
Heather, thank you, and thank you for those two other excellent contributions. Just two tiny little comments, and then I want to take this further. It is what you say about Poland in particular is just so important, because it was 1989, against all the odds, that the Poles reached out to Ukraine. This was talking about frozen conflict. Memory was frozen after 1945 in this part of the world. But after the round table, just before the round table, they reached out and they did a special treaty with Ukraine. Now what's happening is you have a contestation over statues in Lvov, and essentially a confrontation over memory. This is the first point. Secondly, Poles, and I hope there are some Poles here. The Poles did a fantastic job from 2006, 2005, when they had the 100 difficult questions between Russia and Poland. They had this, Rothfeld published this fantastic book. That's not the point I want to make. The Poles, with the support of Germany and the Commission, and can you imagine the Russian Foreign Ministry, they opened up the border between Kaliningrad and yes. Poland. And this is Heather's point, borderlessness. And it was, I was there in Kaliningrad, and the students in Kant University of St. Lavrov opened the borders. And of course, Lavrov knew exactly what this meant. It was the Europeanization, the integration word which you meant. And thousands crossed over. There was a limit of 50 kilometers, 60. It didn't matter. They saw the other world. They saw the other Europe, and they saw what was possible. And guess who closed it? The current law and justice government closed it 2-3 years ago because of cigarette smuggling. Any case, it's a huge setback for trade, but it's a huge setback for identity. So on this point, it begs the question, where are we at now with this kind of foreign policy? Because you have a nationalist-driven foreign policy in Poland. It is an ambiguous foreign policy in Hungary. It supports NATO, but you know, they support all the Hungarian ethnic minorities and have a huge dispute with Ukraine. I mean, they won't even allow this NATO rapprochement with Ukraine, some exercise, I've forgotten the details. But where is this foreign policy now? Where is it on the ground? I mean, memory's contested, foreign policy's contested, borders are contested. Thomas.
Yes, it's. I mean, at face value, it looks as EU foreign policy were completely blocked, both because of the external challenges, but also the internal challenges you mentioned, and then secondly, and I think that was a point that Paul made. Even foreign policy is increasingly politicized. Mm. Maybe not so much in my country, but in other countries. And Paul was raising the question whether that is a good or bad thing. And I think folks forget about good or bad. It's unavoidable. Mm. Yeah, like a lot of things we used to. I mean, you mentioned the permissive consensus and all that. You know, there was a long period of depoliticization of EU affairs, including foreign policy, and that has completely changed. Yeah? And I don't care whether you find this good or bad, but you better get used to it. Yeah? And I think we need to fight these things out inside the EU. I see no other solution. Yeah? And here, I mean, I haven't even mentioned the global. We're still at the borderland. I mean, we have a global situation that is also not really funny, if you want. You know, you have essentially a U.S. administration saying goodbye to pretty much of American foreign policy since World War II. And by the way, I'm totally pessimistic about the future, even if, under my best case scenario, Joe Biden gets elected. Yeah, we're not going to be back. So we have huge challenges, both globally and in the borderlands, etc. At the moment, Europe is not prepared to it.
But, you know, we can say this with every crisis with Europe. And, you know, the Bush administration was pretty, they pulled out of the ABM treaty. They had the old problem with Iraq. The point I want to get at is we have Europe now. You know, it's very easy to blame the Trump administration. But Europe, they couldn't even get a consensus over starting EU negotiations with North Macedonia. After North Macedonia and Greece, against all the odds, broke themselves, thanks to civil society and the courage of Zaev and Dimitrov and Tsipras. But, I mean, what is European foreign policy and the integration word, which you mentioned, if we don't have this political will and imagination to deal with North Macedonia? So there's paralysis on this front and interference by Hungary in this election, in the North Macedonian elections. And it does matter. Regardless of what happens in Washington, foreign policy must act responsibly.
I think the problem is fundamentally lack of strategic vision now. There's a lack of ambition. It's a massive lowering of ambition. The high point was perhaps, you know, when we had both the combination of, you know, good cooperation with the United States, Russia still sorting out its own problems, enlargement giving the EU a broader view of the East, and also within, you know, we had the impetus of new institutional arrangements, new actors here in Brussels, with Solana being there and so on. Now, lots of us, including some of us in this room, were arguing from the very early time that these positions should be merged between Solana and the Commissioner for External Relations. And that kind of made sense, but unfortunately it happened later at a time when the level of ambition was going down and then when there were these massive crises which just absorbed all the political attention, as we see with Brexit now. When you have a massive crisis going on, governments actually become paralysed. 21st century governments actually turn out to have really quite limited capacity to deal with more than one great big thing at a time, which seems completely paradoxical, given they have all the technology at their disposal that their forebears didn't have. But, you know, they just can't walk and chew gum at the same time. And so the problem we have now is that the paralysis, even though the migration crisis has ebbed to a really small number of people actually coming into the European Union, it casts this enormous political shadow that is still inhibiting the growth of any foreign policy initiatives that aren't really related to it. And it's really, and meanwhile, the External Action Service and, you know, it's still finding its place in the system. There's still, and the member state disunity is getting worse, not better. That was the whole point of creating the EAS, was that you would have more unity. But what it has meant is, whereas in the past, you could sometimes actually have a certain amount of freelancing on particular parts of the world that seemed to be rather important for Europe, like the Balkans, where, you know, Solana and his team could go out and really do stuff on the Balkans. The member states were like, oh yes, jolly good, I'm glad you're looking after this. That level of, well, the foreign policy crises don't, instead of these days inspiring a sense of we're going to be surrounded by a ring of fire, we need to go out and do something about it. Instead, it's like, can we just withdraw back a bit further and draw our border a little bit further in, please? And let's not have, you know, we don't, there's a sense that, and this is also to do, of course, with the changing in the zeitgeist after with the liberal order in international level, as you were saying, is much in a much shakier state. But in Europe as a whole, the sense that we can manage our neighbourhood and that's our responsibility, which was really strong for a long time, it's just ebbing. There's a sense that, well, we can't really manage very much, so let's, you know, sauf qui peut, let's protect our own. And for the borderlands, this is a disaster, because instead of being the bulwark of support, of strength and of resilience, the place which you want to rely on to be able to cope with the ebb and flow of geopolitics and the people there being preserving the good relationships with the countries on the other side. Instead, they become the fragile area. Yeah. They become the contested orders. They become more and more the places where it's quite hard for governments to do implementation and enforcement, and they even lose the monopoly on the use of violence. And that's very familiar to anybody who studied the 19th century and before. But, you know, why is it we're returning to this in the 21st century?
It's a very important bit. Before I open this out to the floor, Paul, I want to pick up Heather's point and expand it a little. But the perception from the other side of our borders, they want a strong European foreign policy. They want a sense of direction. So, and it's not coming. So what? How does this push them in terms of their own foreign policy goals?
Listen, I think this is a crucial question. What we found out in previous studies is that what you can see, for instance, those who expect a stronger role of the EU, for instance, among the many surveyed in that project that I mentioned, were the Iranians. And why were the Iranians? Because they saw that the EU had a common position on the nuclear file and an agreement was made, and that made a policy, the EU and different actors converging into that agreement, made the EU a single actor, at least in that particular file. And so there is expectation that this can happen from the other side. There is expectation that this can happen at the EU level. Of course, the problem to me is that these strategic differences very much exist today within the European Union. Mm. Think about Libya, for instance. I mean, the amount of disarray that there is between the member states on Libya is exactly telling you why no matter how the others expect you from doing something coherent, you will not achieve it today mm-hmm. because you are incoherent mm-hmm. inside. And mm-hmm. I think that this is what is the combination of this internal contestation of EU foreign policy by the member states themselves, because the idea that used to be the guiding principle mm-hmm. of EU foreign policy is vanishing because yeah. the world has changed, because normative power is not so easy to do, and so on. So there is internal contestation. This is combined with the moment when more strategic choices and hard strategic choices have to be made, which is the US going its own way, China being like a real power in world politics. So there's the combination yeah. of those two factors happening at the same time. And I think that this is what makes the EU so difficult to act today. One would say, and just let me finish that. One would say in 2003, there was a big disunite in EU foreign policy out of the Iraq war. Mm-hmm. True, it was a big moment for EU foreign policy, but the rest in general was in a happy moment. Yes, then there was the European Constitution later. Yes, I agree. But the euro was being created and put in place. Enlargement was there to come in 2004. Mm-hmm. There are plenty.
The peace deals were holding.
The Balkans were going in a better direction. Mm-hmm. So the crisis of 2003 did not necessarily permeate into the inner mm-hmm. principles and inner choices of the European Union, the internal dynamics of the European Union. That was a foreign policy crisis, true, but today the problem is that the crisis is within the system. It is the European Union in crisis.
I'm willing to take a swath of questions, and if it's okay with all of you, I'd like to take three at a time so that we can have a chance. Maxime, Agnieszka, and then I'll take you the second one. Please introduce yourself and try to be brief.
I'm Maxim Buri from Ukrainian Institute for Public Policy. We are a partner in Kyiv. We are a partner in this project. If I may just make a 1-2 minute comment instead of a question, which would lead to a question, if you agree. Thanks. So first of all, I'd like to raise the issue of resilience, and one value that this project offers is that Ukraine is actually a showcase of resilience and overcoming these areas of limited statehood that existed in 2014, but that currently at a very accelerated pace, resolving themselves despite the external challenges from the order contestant. As we speak, 13 Ukrainian soldiers were killed in April in Donbas, and 4 in May. And Russia is issuing its passports to citizens of these areas. There is a difference between the occupied areas and the areas of limited statehood, which challenges the methodology. This is what we found. And a very quick point, the Please. Order, the different visions of different orders. Only suggest and translate Ukrainian vision, Ukraine considers itself a European country. Okay. Not the EU member states, 63% Ukrainians, according to latest polls, would like to be Ukraine to be a full member of the EU, and it's written in the constitution. And according to one poll, one of the most preferred military allies that the Ukrainians would like to have is Germany, actually. So these visions of orders are also, the more knowledge is brought by the project like this, the more we will have progress towards resolving the differences in this vision. Thank you.
So I see what you mean, the different levels of the contested order, which is a very important point. You've got a question, have you? And could you identify yourself, please? Thank you.
Jakob Semmer, I'm a European Parliament official. Question is my own in my own personal capacity. I would agree with the last speaker. The malaise and the rot goes deep down into the heart of the EU and into the quote-unquote old member state heart of the EU, I believe. I'm afraid I disagree with the moderator's raising of local, low-level, cross-border visa-free traffic to EU foreign policy. It has next to nothing to do with it, and I'm sorry it could be characterized, if I were ill-intentioned, as the quote-unquote liberal elite of the quote-unquote old member states jumping on the bandwagon of bashing quote-unquote the new member states. This has nothing to do with foreign policy. What is EU foreign policy? What have we had as in terms of EU foreign policy? Maybe the Iran deal, which is being proven in the process of being proven to be an empty shell.
Your question?
My question, or rather my final remark will be, of course, this is an open question, is in terms of grand foreign policy, the only tool and the only success, very great success, the EU has had has been enlargement. I wonder if you would agree with me on that. And indeed, the only place or the only way we could continue with the successful tool, of only tool of foreign policy, of real foreign policy of the EU, would be with states due to the size of Ukraine and due to the remoteness of Georgia. However, those two have been blocked by two quote-unquote old member states dragging their feet and knee-jerk reactions to domestic body politic monsters they've awakened. And I have in mind Le Couple Franco-Allemand. Would you agree with that? Thank you.
So, okay, the next question. Can we please keep the questions, keep them focused, please? And we do not have the time for long comments. A short comment maybe, but we have to have Agnieszka, please tell us who you're from.
I will try. Agnieszka Legutska, Polish Institute of International Affairs. I know that Poland do not have a good image now in Brussels, but still I'm very happy that PISM is going to open the bureau here in Brussels. So to have, I'm very happy to maybe have a voice of think tank here and keep informed that we do have in Lublin still conference about the borders, and we did not close the border with Kaliningrad because of the problem with tobacco, but because of the NATO summit was in organized by in Poland. My question goes to the methodology, because when we talk about migration crisis and also blaming Poland to contest that, the problem with migration, we also have a problem to compare the migration issues toward the south and the east. Do you think that that Poland have 2 million almost migrants from Ukraine after the crisis, after the conflict, Russia-Ukrainian conflict. So we do see those migrants as an opportunity, economical and others. In South, we see in the project that we see as a crisis, as a threat, as a risk. So do you see some kind of different view also to the migration issue, comparing to those two regions.
Well, are you getting at the origins of these migrants?
No, I mean from
just wondering.
To compare those,
when it's an opportunity and
dimension. Okay.
So that's the first set of the three questions. Is enlargement a good thing? I think you'll probably find there is a consensus on this. The different elements of resilience, whereas Maxime and the contested orders. And the third issue, you're really asking a question on these different views.
Yeah, because migration is not only the risk.
Absolutely, absolutely. Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, absolutely. So, I don't think there's any debate about enlargement not being a good thing, frankly, but if anybody contests this...
I just want to pick up something else, actually, which is this the paradox of immigration as an issue in foreign policy. And the paradox is that governments, many governments in Europe, largely the same reason, have a bit of a rhetorical gap that you will find the government saying, well, you know, we've got to manage migration, we should keep the numbers down, we only really will accept asylum seekers with a well-founded claim, etc. Meanwhile, the economy is demanding and providing, the economy provides the pull factor for any kind of migrant because there is a huge demand for labor. So you see this in Poland, in say, for example, the construction industry and elsewhere, where there, these 2 million Ukrainians are incredibly important. I mean, the Polish economy would really be in trouble if there were a sudden exodus of Ukrainian workers. Same for Italy, with workers who come across the Mediterranean to pick all the oranges. So you've got, and agriculture also in Poland is very important. Same with agriculture in the UK, by the way, mm-hmm. which is basically collapsing with the loss of many migrants who come to pick the fruit. So we've got quite a big hypocrisy, I think, in Europe, that the migration issue is presented as either being a humanitarian crisis, which it can be at times, or it's being presented as an unwelcome pressure. And in practice, the issues about labour markets and the labour demand is very rarely discussed.
Yeah.
That's also a foreign policy issue. Yeah. It's also a foreign policy issue. Mm. And that's a long-term structural issue. Mm-hmm. And so if we had a more rational policy, which is not driven by the sense of crisis and this huge political shadow I was talking about, it would actually be about those labour market issues.
Yeah.
And how should Europe have a pan-European policy for legal migration to work in labour markets where migrants are very much needed and actually have that coordinated? Whereas at the moment, it's still very much between individual member states who decide it. But the problem with this is because governments have this paradoxical and somewhat hypocritical position, they're very unwilling to talk about it. They're very unwilling. So they will talk about the need for trade in goods and even in services, but they're very unwilling to talk about labour and about human beings as a part of trade as well. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the problems that we have. And then the population is actually denied an opportunity to think about it in those kinds of terms and to think about what would happen, I think some people have seen the famous Italian film on The Day Without Migrants, what would happen to the Italian economy if all the migrants suddenly disappeared. The economy just simply would not function. So that's, I think that's part of the problem. And that it's also, the other part of the problem is that borders are now seen as primarily as barriers, as fences. We bought the Trump idea that borders keep people out, when actually human history shows they largely don't. And to no matter how much money you spend on them, and any border guard will tell you that what you actually rely on is the local populations knowing what the rules are, more or less, and essentially keeping order on the border. Mm. It's incredibly difficult for a thin blue line and a razor wire fence to do that job. You actually need the people. And I just finished by telling you the funniest thing I ever heard. I worked in a Finnish cabinet in the commission, with the Finnish commissioner for 5 years. And I heard a number of Finnish arguments about EU foreign policy towards Russia and so on. And my favourite one of all time was how the CAP is one of the EU's absolutely most important foreign policy and indeed CSDP tools. And the reason why is Finland has the longest border with Russia of any member state, thousands and thousands of kilometres. It mostly can't be patrolled because it's too long, and in the winter the snow drifts are too high and there are blizzards and all of this. So you can't have razor wire fences. So the only way that Finland can defend that border on behalf of the European Union is by having farmers living on that land and farming so that they can, call up Helsinki when they see somebody coming over the border or some fishy stuff going on. Therefore, growing sugar beet and CAP subsidies to grow sugar beet in those regions of the borderlands is an absolutely vital part of European security.
Super. Voila. You just explained why foreign policy is not traditional foreign policy. Paul,
no,
you wanted to jump in.
And this is also, these are questions on migration. I'll build on this, on the facts, reality versus perception aspect on migration. And here I have, of course, much more knowledgeable experts on Germany, but when facts have come and studies have come out in terms of what the impact of the refugee crisis has been and what the status of those refugees are, then you see that 3/4 are doing German courses, that 33% speak good German as of today, that 35% are in work. And these are figures that assess those questions that were put into the table at that moment by saying this is really a threat. Okay, confront this threat, this emotional threat, with facts, and then you might get some sort of other answers. And this is also to complement what Heather was saying. But with migration, and I come from Spain, so migration in Spain has never been a truly emotional fact, despite the huge amount of numbers that have in a very short time arrived to Spain in the last few decades. And I keep asking, why is that? Mm. Huh? So why is it that Spain, of course, there's a historical issue about the presence of the far right that has been broken now in parliament. We have a far right party also in parliament. We were the exception, and we are no longer the exception with the rise of Vox. But something that I think needs to be confronted to a certain extent is very often the discussion on migration is brought not to the rational level, as Heather was saying, and I agree that this should be part of the discussion, but it's not brought to the rational level, it's brought to the emotional level. And my answer in many of those fora where this is brought to the emotional level as this is a threat, this is a challenge for our social security, they will steal our services and so on, bring it to the personal level. Okay, tell me how many migrants do you encounter every day on a daily basis when you do your daily work and your daily life? And tell me where the problem emanates when you interact with these migrants. And most of the time, you will see that there's no such problem in the daily life. Mm. There's one caveat here, and there are some spheres of the population that suffer more from the consequences of migration than others. But this then is a socioeconomic problem that you need to tackle with socioeconomic powerful tools. But do not bring it to something that you cannot discuss and bring it only to the rationality when there's an emotional part, but confront it to emotional things.
It's into Agnes's question. Thomas, you wanted to...
Okay. Three quick points. The first one is very, very quick. I simply agree with you, Agnieszka. Basta. I regret it enormously that that we gave up the opportunity discourse on migration. You know, and this is still haunting us. You know, in my country, with the demographic change and so forth, and Paul just gave all the numbers. So, number one. Number two. On the open border issue, I'm afraid we cannot give up. This is constitutive for the European Union. Then you want a completely different European Union, and I don't want to be part of it. And by the way, with all the malaise, etc., the EU is still a pretty good global actor when it comes to open economy. And that means also something about the borders. Yeah, this is constitutive. This is constitutive for us. So if we start giving, and I still see a consensus here, despite all these contestations. Yeah. My last point is really on Maxim and the resilience issue. It's a concept that I find it's still poorly understood. It pops up in the global strategy, but it just pops up. I mean, there are a couple of sentences. It's not really clear what it actually means, but if you look at the literature on this stuff, and this is where we try to understand and organize what, and where I think the EU has a role to play is precisely fostering societal resilience in various areas of limited statehood, so that they can cope with contestation issues. Somebody talked about Russian interference and whatnot, etc. And this kind of societal resilience, I think, is absolutely crucial. And that is actually something where the EU, in its old foreign policy stuff, from enlargement, but in the neighborhood, there's a lot of policy tools here that the EU actually has, and that is not very much contested. And if you see, if you see what, for example, the EU, but also a lot of member states right now are doing in Tunisia, I think they're exactly doing the right thing there. That is strengthening societal resilience, which also gets me to the point that you tried to raise, and then we didn't pick up on it, that foreign policy is way more than just state-to-state anymore. So I wanted to bring civil society organizations in there. Or political foundations. I mean, my country, the role of political foundations and so forth.
It's really important what you say, and it touches on Heather's aspect of the CAP, but on trade, and we have this endless debate in Germany, shouldn't you merge the Department of the Economics Ministry and the Foreign Ministry and the the development ministry, what tons of money is duplicated sometimes. But you could have a really new coherent foreign policy. Thanks for this contribution. So we have three or four more. You're first, Tanya's second, this lady behind Tanya's fourth, third, and you're fourth. Please, and please, really focused.
Robert Soltik, ex-journalist, now commission official, but I will speak as a historian. Borderlands has a very strong meaning in the Polish history and national mythology. Basically, it means keep Russia out, Ukraine and Belarus down, and Poland in. I don't think that this is a political concept which is of 21st century. And even the most nationalistic Poles would probably don't dream about such a scenario. However, when the borderlands in the history were burning, it was the moment when the Polish nobles were getting wheat, getting arms, and going east. What is happening? Our borderlands are burning, and we are talking. We are not really in an action mode, whether it is on the south or whether it is on the east. I don't think that the borderlands concept means bringing Ukrainians to the EU. It rather, I hope, means what the Eastern Partnership was about, make Ukraine strong again and make them stay where they are, happy in their country. What is happening now is they are not so much happy of their country. They just elected a president which was a symbol of the discontent. They are voting with their legs, and we have a problem. On the south, we have the problem even bigger, because we don't even have the possibility of people expressing their will or trying to build statehood. So my question is the borderlands a concept of a policy, or rather acknowledgement that we don't have one?
Okay, thank you. Tanya, please.
Tanya Wörzel, Freie Universität.
Could you say who you are?
Yeah, Tanya Wörzel, Freie Universität Berlin, and I have the pleasure to coordinate together with Thomas Iulisco. And I mean, following up what you just said, I think borderlands appears to be a contested concept. You know, I mean, the panel essentially emphasizes more positive connotation, like it's sort of permeable borders that facilitate the exchange of people and goods and so on. And may I remind you that there is a video game that is called Borderlands. It's a world action role-play ego shooter video game where four so-called vault hunters travel to a distant planet and hunt down an alien vault, battling the local fauna and all kinds of, you know, monsters, and particularly the bandit population. So it has a very negative connotation, a kind of as a risk and threat. And I think that needs to be taken into account, right? Here comes now my question. Mm-hmm. You seem to all agree, whether you have a positive or negative understanding of borderlands, that the EU and its member states need to respond to the challenges or whatever opportunities borderlands present. And then you also seem to agree that, and that should go beyond hardening the EU's outer borders, right? But then you also seem to agree that the multiple crises of the EU appear to prevent the EU and its member states to develop such a policy. But I tend to agree with Judy. And I'm not so sure whether this is also new, what we currently do. So my question here is, how should or would an EU's and member states' foreign policy toward the borderlands look like if the EU hadn't gone through the multiple crises? Do you really, sort of, I guess I'm asking, do they really make a difference? Okay. Or didn't the EU never, hasn't the EU never had really a policy towards this border plan? So that's a question.
And a tough one. I'm not going to answer this. And please, it's not my job to. Please, if you could.
Thank you. Christina Kausch with the German Marshall Fund.
Oh, English. Hello.
Genau, hi. So we've heard from you that the distinction between domestic and foreign policy is vanishing. That seems like quite a big structural change. So if you take that thought one step further, doesn't that mean that the structures that devise foreign policy and domestic policy must be integrated as well? Perhaps the external action service should be an internal action service or just an action service. So my question is, to which degree are our policy-making structures fit to grasp that kind of complexity?
Okay. Institutional reform. We have room for... Hello.
Hello. Andrea Strignitz. I work in the European Parliament. Two reflections. I think the EU is strong in the non-traditional foreign affairs, like trade and development policy, but weak in the traditional ones. CSDP is just at the starting point, and the traditional diplomacy. But here's maybe a responsibility of the member states. When we have a Minsk process where Mogherini is not sitting at the table, how can you expect a coherent EU foreign policy? Mm-hmm. It's just driven by Merkel and Macron. So we cannot blame the EU for that. Second point, the EU foreign policy it's in the treaties, values-driven, human rights, democracy, rule of law. So this is very positive, but it also makes things much more difficult. Take the example of the Balkans. It's easier for a country like China and Russia to act than for the EU with these kind of self-restrictions. My question is, do you think we can come to a more coherent policy by changing from unanimity to majority voting? Because that seems to me crucial.
Well, that's very interesting because Charlie Grant's Institute did a paper on this, a short discussion on this in their latest paper. Oh boy, these are big questions. The EU members, had there not been a multiple crisis, that's the first question, had there not been multiple crises, but the EU member states and EU see the borderlands differently? Mm-hmm. Let's deal with this first, not to confuse the issue.
I love counterfactuals, because you never know whether you're right or wrong, actually. It's a great board, kind of after-dinner game. How would it have been if the euro had all been totally fine? The UK joined, of course, at the very beginning, along with Sweden and Denmark, and then migration policy had actually been, both the euro had been consolidated in the early 2000s, and also migration policy had been created at EU level. What would that mean for the borderlands? Well, I think it would mean several quite big differences. One would be that there would be legal pathways for migration. So we might actually have a similar number of migrants because the labour migration is on supply and demand in the economy. You probably have a similar number. It's just that they would be legal. They'd be paying taxes. They'd be paying social security. They would feel much more happier in the societies that they're working in. They'd be sending remittances home. And in fact, we might have closer links with their home countries, whether that be just over the border in Ukraine or it be Burkina Faso, depending on how that works. So that could be rather different. It could look more like, for example, Australia, until they've had their own political crisis. But if you think about the historical, you know, migration to Australia, you do still have the links with the home country more. So the legal pathways, I think, could have been there. There was a great moment when there was a lot of support for that in the European Union from all of the member states. And that, you know, it's a classic missed opportunities. And then, of course, if there had not been that crisis, there would have been less of a crisis of values like the one we're having now about rule of law. Mm. Now, that's domestic politics and power plays by particular political parties, I would argue. But those parties would then themselves be rather less vulnerable and dependent on Russian support of various kinds. And that would affect the eastern borderlands too. Mm. Because, you know, look at the various deals that have been done recently, everything from the nuclear plant and the civilian nuclear plant in Hungary through to various defence deals. Those could have looked different too. And I think this concept of resilience that Paul first brought up and which Tomáš has taken as well, this is really critical that... and it relates to then the question about representative democracy that I'd like to bring up in response to Christina's question, which is we can all think about the historical missed opportunities when the EU just didn't quite get its act together to put in place a policy framework which would have provided the resilience, the political as well as policy resilience, to cope with crises without massive disunity between the member states and a paralysis of decision making being the result. And the problem with that is, in some ways, that the what we what I think you referred to, Paul, as the politicization of foreign policy. It's also the democratization of foreign policy, which historically wasn't really there. Mm. The reason why diplomats lived in a slightly rarefied world was because foreign ministries were kind of, they were out of domestic mm-hmm. politics. It was very rare that you had a foreign policy crisis that was big enough for the domestic population to notice. But now, everybody has an opinion yeah. on foreign policy. So I think the question, I would reframe your question, Christina, not so much as are policymaking structures fit to deal with yeah. complexity? Obviously not. But is representative democracy fit to deal with the externalities of foreign policy, where you can't take account of the interests of the people who yeah. are affected by your foreign policy as well?
That gets into the thorny issue of referendum. Paul, did you want to say something here?
On the counterfactual exercise, also, had it been, to compliment on Heather's, had it been the case where everything would have been nice and beautiful at the EU level, also, we might have seen that, and this goes also a bit counterfactually with the EU LISCO as well. Huh? I mean, we discuss limited statehood and we all agree that it's present very much, but also remember the situation immediately post-Arab Spring. We were mm-hmm. thinking at that moment that societal forces might become much stronger, that there would be something beyond mm-hmm. the states, that there would be the possibility of civil societies mm-hmm. to gathering and doing something new, renew politics in the Arab world and so on. Well, to a certain extent, state resilience has also proven quite strong in a few countries, right? I mean, think about Egypt. Think about Egypt, right? In an opposite way, right? Yeah. So also perhaps if we had been at the EU level much stronger in having our own foreign policy and doing things right, because we wouldn't have this internal crisis, we would have also been better equipped to deal with those scenarios where states matter and where power politics still matter. And I think this is something happening everywhere in other places of the world, right? But also, and I like Christina's counter, I remember her piece on the UFM at some point and about the institutional dimensions. But yes, I mean, of course, the integration of internal and external should come together with institutional reforms. But ask a police officer in Spain to merge with a military command and you will easily see how this becomes impossible between the Ministry of Interior and the Ministry of the Army, right? And so the institutional burden, and I did a lot of studies on this, is what makes it impossible. The problem is, some steps have been taken at the EU level. Mm-hmm. Some bold mm-hmm. steps have been taken in the last few years. Mm-hmm. It is whatever is PESCO, EDF. I mean, you can mention steps in the right direction that might have been taken and that have made progress. Problem is, if you do not go into the core business of differences and the strategic vision and the way to put things together and the political level, then these steps are good. I'm not saying they're bad, but they're insufficient.
But this ties in with this question. I think somebody on the panel must answer the question. The present voting system for foreign policy would qualified majority be better? Would it be more effective, or would the smaller states feel that it would be ganged up by the bigger states? Would it be effective for Europe's they don't have global ambitions, but Europe's foreign policy?
Probably, but my take is that it would always come, this reform, with a caveat on saying, unless there are questions of existential interest for a member state, then this cannot be put into place. And I think that any reform about QMV would necessarily still preserve the fact that in some existential things, unanimity remains. So I don't think that there is any real bold possibility to go into that direction as of now. I mean, we would be thinking about another sort of discussions that would bring us to debates about flexible integration, multi-speed and all that, but that is another.
Thomas, please, and then another round.
I would be in favor of QMV, but it wouldn't make much of a difference. I mean, I remember the discussions, you know, some people after the Brexit referendum were saying, oh, great, the Brits are out and finally can have a cohesive foreign policy. Now, we have 3 years now to test this one out, all right? So I don't see this. However, I'd say, and then this relates, I think it was your comment on that the EU really does non-traditional types of foreign, the stronger we go, the more we go into sort of traditional military policy, the less we can do. I actually think that on the EU level, these coordination and the the interaction between the domestic and the foreign policy, that on the EU level, the EU might be way better prepared to do these kind of things than actually a lot of member states. I mean, I remember I was involved in the drafting of the German guidelines toward fragile states, crisis prevention, etc. The coordination game between the defense ministry, the foreign ministry, and the foreign aid, and the interior wasn't even there, was a nightmare, a total, complete nightmare. The bureaucratic politics involved in this thing, the whole process was bogged down for about three quarters of a year. You know, so in fact, I think if we talk the non-traditional stuff, this is where the EU has its strength, and this is coming back to the resilience part. This is what is needed. And finally, this is also where you can bring in your values, human rights, etc., etc. I mean, in my view, the EU has gone from grandiose rhetoric on normative power and we the force of a good, da-da-da-da-da, paired with the practice of complete double standards toward stability, and the outcome was Sisi in Egypt, or backing, we weren't responsible for that, but we backed it, you know, behind closed doors, but and now in a situation where we try to come back and think about a foreign policy that tries to deal with these various dilemmas, between security and human rights. Long term, it's all good, but I mean, in the short term, you can have goal conflicts, and you have to deal with this inevitably. And I do think that the move toward fostering resilience, that's why I'm pushing this so, could be one where you could talk about your values in a much more down-to-earth way, rather than the grandiose rhetoric.
But this was the gist of a commission paper about 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, looking at the whole issue of stabilization. And I remember having a long discussion with the authors of that, heard of the values fit in, but they said you have to have stabilization first and then you build the institutions. A very quick intervention, you wanted to say something. Quickly.
No, just a comment on the Brits. I would disagree, because the experts say on CSTP that we have achieved in security and defense, paradoxically, much more without the Brits in the last 3 years than before, 10 years ago. Although the UK is, we all agree, a big contributor and the biggest army and so on and so on and so on, but now without the bridge, we came in security and defense much further, I think. That's what the experts say on CSTP.
Oh, I don't know about that. And we can continue this.
It's a little bit contested.
Yes, it is very contested. You wonder why the French and the Brits got together several times, because the SDP was doing nothing. Please, yes. And then Corneille.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is André de Munter, European Parliament. I work on Western Balkans and Turkey. And I'm, by the way, I'm a keen reader of Judy Asks.
Yes.
So, Judy, you mentioned earlier, I mean, the inability of the EU to reach even consensus on opening accession negotiations with North Macedonia. I couldn't agree more. And this brings me to the Belgrade-Pristina dialogue, where we have seen the US moving in massively over the past months with multiple visits to the region, proposals, etc., Trump even inviting them already to sign the protocol in Haradina in Kosovo is capitalizing on that. I think this dialogue, which does not merit even the name dialogue, especially not since last summer, is a prime example of our inability. And we had on the 29th of April this German-French initiative, meeting, summit, whatever we would call it. Mm-hmm. I would like to have, if possible, the views of the panel or one of the panelists on this, whether this is like a sign that, I mean, basically they want to take it out of the hands of Federica Mogherini.
Just that Berlin, don't take Macron on board, that Berlin wants to take this out of the hands of Mogherini.
Yes.
Okay.
Or that this is like an initiative to see what happens on the ground.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
After all, there will be a follow-up meeting in Paris also.
But remember, it was Berlin that launched the Berlin process a couple of years ago with the Brits.
Exactly. I have my own thoughts on the Berlin process, which is too elitist and too ad hoc.
I see what, that's a very good question.
Thank you.
Of the member states trying to take whatever it is out of Marguerite Sands. Cornelia, back, please.
Cornelia Kagachev, Georgian Institute of Politics. I actually wanted to challenge the term resilience. I mean, it has different meaning in different parts of the world. And for instance, in Eastern Partnership, for instance, resilience is sometimes translated or understood as a kind of magic word which was coined in some way in EU capitals, basically telling to the member countries that they should take care of their own security on themselves. But the problem, and it sounds sometimes very cynical, you know, from that perspective. But the thing is that, is it realistic, for instance, when you talk about Eastern Partnership like Georgia, Ukraine, some other countries? I mean, these countries are very small. They can never balance the Russia. So sometimes, basically, we have a region in Eastern Partnership which somebody calls like a security orphan, somebody like gray zone or whatever. But I don't think that in long term you can have that kind of region for long term. So what is missing is sometimes some sort of vision from European Union what to do with this region in long term. And also another thing, and I wanted to ask this question, that whether European leaders and European Union wants to like it or not, but as we see the recent history, basically the EU has to somehow react to the crisis which we have in this neighborhood and we will have in the future. So what maybe is there any kind of like maybe idea to strengthen the role of EU as a crisis manager? Because what is happening sometimes is that EU is a little bit behind of the crisis, and it's always not really you know, like helpful to
involve. This is really complicated. I take these two complicated questions. The first one, it's always been quite Berlin, Berlin and London, I know you have your views of this Berlin summit, and so have I, the one that started a few years ago. But quite frankly, where is the EEAS and Mogherini in the Western Balkans? Cathy Ashton at least focus on the Serbia-Kosovo rapprochement. So the question is, I mean, I can't answer this, but I mean, does Merkel really want to take it out of Mogherini's hands? At least Mogherini was there in Berlin. But I mean, it was a bit of a fiasco. Yeah, I know. It was a bit of a fiasco given that Macron was very... very ambiguous towards the whole issue of our own back garden. And if we can't put stability and a perspective in our own back garden, what global ambitions can we have? But I don't want to interfere in the answer. And the second one was even more complicated. So, yeah, please, Thomas.
I give a try at resilience, but I make an academic statement now, okay? So, we started as part of EU-LISCO to get, after we saw these words in the global strategy and we made the mistake to put it in our application. So we thought, okay, now we have to think about what it actually means. So you look at the literature. And I think what the concept as it was developed primarily from sociology is a concept that takes it for granted that we live, A, in a complex world, and secondly, in a world that is constantly changing. And that coping with the situation means you have to adapt to change and complexity. So in a way, stability is the opposite of resilience. Yeah? If stability means no change. Mm-hmm. Okay? This is sort of where this concept comes from. So now this is very abstract and theoretical. But then if you start to translate it in actual politics, it actually gives you a way out of this, you know, instant revolution everywhere to foster human rights, democracy, and the rest of it, versus stability of autocratic regimes. Yeah? Mm. And I think this is, so if if this is understood in Georgia or elsewhere that the EU is telling you to take care of yourself, I think that's a big misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if we talk about fostering resilience, we are fostering means again taking an active part in helping others to develop these kind of forces to cope with changes, with disruptions, and these kind of situations. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's an active concept. It is not a passive concept. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And this is why I want to emphasize civil society at this point. This is not about strengthening the state.
Yeah.
It is sometimes understood in that way, mm-hmm. but in my view, from the literature I've been familiar with, this has absolutely nothing to do with the sociological origins of that concept.
Yes. I'm going to pass this over to Heather and Paul.
Theoretical and abstract.
But just one thing about the resilience. It could go the other way. Isn't Assad extremely resilient? He's propped up militarily. Mm-hmm. But you could change the definition of resilience as well. I mean, it's not. I agree on the civil society aspect, but stability versus resilience. The Poles were incredibly resilient under communism, but some West European countries wanted Poland to remain stable. So there was a conflict between the resilience and the stability. Heather.
Yeah, I mean, I think we started off this evening talking about, you know, ambitions for change versus ambitions for everything to stay the same. Mm. And as in many things, also as in life, your willingness to accept change, even to promote change, depends enormously on how secure you feel in your own capacities. You see this in human beings as well. Mm. The psychological idea of resilience as being a human capacity of emotional resilience, of keeping the integrity of the self in the face of massive change, is all about your rootedness. Yes. And feeling secure in your identity, feeling secure in who you are and in having a community around you. Now, this, I think, actually applies rather well psychologically to nation states as well, that when they feel secure in their identity and they feel that they've got a community of friends around them whom they can rely on if they run into trouble, it works much better. And that is the principle underlying European integration, that European integration allows nation states to feel, I mean, think about Spain, for example, after the transition in the 70s and 80s, to regain a sense of identity and to feel secure that there are other countries to draw on if problems emerge, either from foreign problems, but also within your own society. And the EU we're supposed to provide that kind of security, both identity and help of various kinds. Now, the EU is clearly no longer doing that for some of its member states. And I would argue that's because of domestic politics has made it convenient for leaders to create crises which make the EU look like the problem rather than the solution. And so that's a reframing of the European Union. But it means that in foreign policy terms, the level of ambition goes down not just to the lowest common denominator, which has frequently been the case in EU foreign policy, but to a sub-zero denominator, which is how can we use this to pump up the idea that the EU is the problem and not the solution. Mm-hmm. You see that now in the blocking of United Foreign Policy positions in any document that has the M word in it.
Yeah.
As soon as migration appears in any document, it is no longer possible for that to be an EU document signed off by all of the member states. Now, I'm not convinced that QMV is necessarily the answer. It might, in a way, that kind of ship has passed because it's not the voting so much which is the issue, because they can't even get a text in the first place. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing. But I think one thing to... what's the kind of... You know, if you're not going to join the Global Compact on Migration, for example, then what's the point of QMV? But but the other thing is that in terms of delivery of foreign policy, a lot of that is... The resources are still at member state level.
Yeah.
You know, the budget of the EEAS is not very large. Of course, you've got DG DevCo and you've got various other budgets. Even CAP, I would argue, is actually a rather significant foreign policy kind of tool of various kinds. It's just not necessarily employed like that. But it's still at member state level, it still really matters. And that is still in the hands of capital. So to come back to the borderlands, I think one of the things to look at is we're all a bit obsessed because of Brexit and Trump and populism and all of that with looking at the UK is out, blah, 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 but look at what's happening in terms of foreign policy making actors. Who actually makes foreign policy? And I just come up with two observations on this, which matter to the borderlands. One of them is it's actually a really small number of member states that have a foreign policy, mm-hmm. that have any foreign policy mm-hmm. ambition. Mm-hmm. It's a really small number. Yeah. And even those who have it, it tends to be just over their border. So that makes the borderlands more significant, but it means that there's more of a national role and less yes. of an EU role. So if you think about policy on Morocco, that is largely made by Spain, that's mm-hmm. essentially. Mm-hmm. And that's a rather... significant because yeah. Spain might do a very good job.
Yeah.
It could also, but it's not going to be a European policy. And the second thing is, foreign policy is back in the national capitals. Yeah. It's Absolutely. The capitals who decide. It is not actually, it's not yeah. between Lublin and no. Lviv. It's actually yeah. all made in Warsaw okay. these days. Whereas there was a period in which there was a bit more dispersal mm-hmm. of an interest of regions. Now, of course, we're now getting quite a lot of regionalism coming up and so on. Who knows? We might have it made yeah. in Edinburgh or you know Barcelona or wherever. But for the moment, it's very solidly in national capitals. So that you have to look at where the energy is. And I think on foreign policy, it's paradoxically kind of moved back to the nation state, but then to the capital.
I think there's a complete agreement on this, which nearly answers your question about the Western Balkans. Paul, would you like to give
just
your...
one additional point on the resilience yeah. aspect, which I think builds in also nicely into what we're doing in EULISCO in the work package on instruments and policies of the EU. There is, of course, the understanding of resilience, making others adaptive to change, making them more capable of kind of yeah. having a more sound internal situation and capacity building, which was a bit what was raised in the question. But there is also, and I think this is very present in the EU global strategy, another understanding of resilience, which speaks very much about ourselves, not only promoting resilience outside, mm-hmm. but also promoting resilience yeah, yeah. inside.
Yes,
and being more resilient at the EU level, that also yeah. means having an EU global strategy that is action-oriented, that brings coherence within the different strands of foreign policy and external relations and so on. So it's also a nice way of... a nice narrative to be adopted by those who need, mm-hmm. who also think that need to make a more sound external action apparatus on the EU. So I think that the resilience side of the EU global strategy was an idea meant to both speak externally but also yes. internally.
And it's interesting how NATO and the EU were using the same word at the yeah. at an EU summit more so. Just before I wrap up this, Heather, when you joined the Commission, I think, where are you? You weren't with Verheugen, were you?
No,
it was Olli Rehn. Yeah. And I bumped into Heather at a meeting, and she said, oh, Judy, you know what gets me about the EU? Process. Process, process, process. And I just leave you with this question, maybe it's for another day. Has the money process outlived itself, given what everybody mentioned, the complexity and change? On that note, I want to thank a terrific panel, Thomas Ries from the Freie Universität Berlin, Heather Graber from the Open Youth Society, Ukraine Director, and Paul Morillas from CEDAW in Barcelona. And a terrific audience. Thank you very much for all the questions, and thank you, Carnegie, for hosting it.
Well, thank you.